You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. Welcome to the program, A Good Book. This is part 8 of the book, Late for the Bus, An Adoption Story, Finding My Birth Parents, Jerry and Joanne Buss. I'm your volunteer reader, Lee Close, and I am also the author of the book. This is the true story of finding my birth parents after years of fruitless searching, only to discover that I am the eldest daughter of Dr. Gerald Buss, the multimillionaire, legendary owner of the Los Angeles Lakers, and his wife, Joanne. Highlights from the previous broadcast: a new corporate career begins. My birth father, Dr. Buss, purchases the Los Angeles Lakers in 1979. My family and I moved to California for my new job with the Avery label, and also the sad passing of my beloved Aunt Faye, the Lakers fan extraordinaire. We continue on the reading now with my job with Avery label. Commuting from Irvine to Covina every day was not my favorite way to spend time, but working in the office was necessary in order to design the Avery Eigner training manual. Once the training program was complete, in addition to Los Angeles, I traveled to the major cities of New York, Chicago, Minneapolis, and Dallas to present the new program to the combined sales force. With the merger project completed and no more travel, I realized I was stuck in a place I did not want to be. So in 1986, I left the company and our family moved back to Arizona. Dad was now in a wheelchair after having one of his legs amputated due to vascular problems, and I was anxious to return to be closer to my parents. Paul and I purchased a home on the golf course at Arrowhead Country Club in Glendale. Scott started his sophomore year back in Arizona, just like I had done so many years ago. When he turned 16, we got in the car and drove to a retail center. I told him I'd wait in the car while he filled out job applications at all the stores. Personable and enthusiastic, Scott lined up his first job at McDonald's, and if I taught him anything, it was to always be on time and work hard. We were a golf-playing family, and my son went on to be captain of his high school golf team as a senior. Over the years, we purchased 3 more homes in Arrowhead, literally within walking distance from each other. I loved the thrill of buying a home, fixing it up, putting my signature on it, and then selling it and buying another, all in the same zip code. No stress, just fun. Soon after leaving Avery and moving back to Arizona, Rubbermaid, my former employer, offered me the position of Western Regional Manager. I would cover 11 Western states in a new division, Rubbermaid Home Office Products. With my prior mass market background with Rubbermaid and my office supply background with Avery, I was the perfect fit. All 3 regional managers were female. Peggy, Michelle, and I were referred to as Charlie's Angels, a popular TV show a few years prior. Before the first new home office product was manufactured, we set out to hire rep groups nationwide in order to bring the product from concept to shelf. I was fortunate to have Price Club in San Diego as my target account, and I sold the first $1 million order of a single product called the Box Office. My Los Angeles-based independent manufacturer's rep made a 5% commission, $50,000, on that one order. He celebrated by buying 2 Mercedes, one for himself and one for his wife. That milestone made me think about the idea of being independent. But the corporate world had its perks, too. Hawaii was part of my territory, and I had acquired lots of free airline miles, so I took my mom with me on a business trip to Honolulu and rented a convertible to cruise Oahu with her. On a separate trip, I brought my son with me, and while I was working a trade show, our hotel arranged for him to play Pearl Country Club in a foursome with golfers from Japan. In his senior year, while he was captain of the high school golf team, Paul and I took him to Scotland to play the old course at St. Andrews. I still regret not teeing up with them that day, but it was cold and had been raining all the way from Edinburgh. In the car, Scott pleaded, "But Mom, they play golf in the rain here." As soon as we arrived, the skies opened up, the caddies were ready, and the day turned out to be perfect. Fun travels aside, the quick success of the startup division at Rubbermaid, oddly enough, became our downfall as well. Within a couple of years, our new little enterprise was rolled under the Housewares division. Peggy, Michelle, and I were bummed that, without our knowledge, this realignment was in all likelihood part of the initial strategic plan. I acutely remembered why I had become disenchanted with the company the first time around. They say, "You can never go home again," but I hadn't realized this maxim applied to me. By this time in 1988, recruiters knew who I was, and women managers were in demand. I received a call to return to the commercial office supply industry by way of an offer from Keith Clark, a calendar company. My new position was that of Western Regional Manager in their new Consumer Products Division. Though I would be based in Arizona, I would be covering the Northwest, West, Southwest, and the Southeast portions of the country for the mass, gift, and military markets. This new job gave me the largest territory I had covered to date, together with the highest salary. There were three regional managers, but this time I was the only woman. All of Keith Clark's manufacturing was in the USA, and in addition to sales, our group of three, along with our vice president, were involved in product color and design. The student planner was our most successful new item, and I was fortunate to have Price Club once again as a target account. They purchased and sold over 25,000 units. In 1987 and 1988, my biological father, Dr. Jerry Buss, would win his fourth and fifth NBA championship. In 1988, Dr. Buss and Karen, his longtime girlfriend, would give birth to my second half-sibling, Jesse Buss. I now had four brothers and two sisters, none of whom knew I existed. Saying goodbye to my dad, Jimmy. In 1989, my dad passed away, leaving a hole in my heart. In a 1984 Christmas letter, he had written to his friends and family that he had a serious heart condition show up in 1980 involving intensive care, and since that time had been hospitalized six times and experienced three major operations. He had diabetes, congestive heart failure, and had been in and out of the hospital for as long as I could remember. Keeping his chin up all through the diagnoses, he had taken up oil painting as a pastime and made the best of his limited mobility. His talent in oils was apparent, and he was mentored by an artist, an alcoholic who gave him painting lessons while my dad sponsored him through AA. Whenever I would ask him how he was feeling, my dad would smile and say, "Pretty good shape for the shape I'm in." As an artist, his passion was painting scenes of the Arizona desert he loved so much. Creating art was of great comfort to him. His oil paintings are my treasures. My dad died on March 25th, the Saturday after Good Friday. I was 35 years old and living nearby, so I was able to visit him in the emergency room that Friday night. His blue eyes were faded, his body hooked up with tubes, but he still managed a smile. After visiting him so many times in the hospital over the years, I knew this time he would not be coming home. "You hate all this shit, don't you?" My exact words. He nodded yes, and as they wheeled him away, the nurses suggested we go home for the night. The next afternoon, Paul and I received a call from my mom, who said her car would not start. "The hospital called. He is not going to last much longer. Please hurry." When we arrived at the hospital, my father had already passed. This was my third viewing of a body, but this time it was different. He was still in his hospital bed. I kissed him on the forehead, his body still warm, but I knew his soul was no longer there. When we walked outside the hospital, it was getting dark. We heard thunder, and the skies were lighting up, ready to storm. As we got in the car to go home, I thought about his young life in Texas and his stories of the balls of lightning rolling across the highway. Good night, Daddy. I love you. People came from Southern California and all over Arizona to say goodbye to Jimmy. I wrote in my journal at the time that the Baptist funeral was nothing short of a tent revival. So many people spoke kind words of how Jimmy had helped them through their darkest drinking days. After the service, a man from Covina came up to me, introduced himself, and shook my hand. "Are you the youngest?" "Yes." "Okay, so you're the one who gave your father so much trouble, running away from home and all that." I was embarrassed and didn't know what to say. He continued to talk. "He was so proud of your accomplishments in the business world, and he talked about you all the time." "Thank you for letting me know. I appreciate that." Mom held up well during this sad time. Before Dad died, he told her, "Do not come to the cemetery to see me. I am not there. Go on living." And that's exactly what she did. She joined a nearby Baptist church and a widow's group, and most importantly, she danced whenever she got the chance. After his funeral, she wrote in her journal, "People come into our lives to stay only as long as God directs, to show love and touch our lives in such a way that, in a way, it's like a vapor floating in and leaving a faint perfume of things that we shared. It returns at times and takes us back again to the beautiful things we shared, good time and bad. A remembered touch of their hand, and peace comes. Things just happen. A chapter of one's life closes, and we find we never really got to know the person at all. We may find a lot of questions were never asked, and a lot of secrets were not told. We think we know how we would handle a loss till that time comes. Then we find we are not ready to let them go." After nearly 50 years of marriage, Maddie was still in love with Jimmy. For better or for worse, in sickness and in health, they were a team until his very last breath. You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is the program A Good Book. We're reading the book Late for the Bus. I'm your volunteer reader, Lee Close, and the author of the book. Chapter 8. Non-identifying information. Your history is not your destiny. Dr. Carl Hammerschlag. My son Scott graduated from high school in May 1989, just a few months after Dad's funeral. He was fortunate to have spent so much time with his grandfather. They were pals. The loss of my dad changed my life. It felt hollow. He was always interested in my life and career. My mom was the rock, and my dad, the thinker, the one who was willing to discuss any subject at length with me. But a year after his death, that adoption wound started oozing up again. I felt so alone, and I started thinking about my other father. Could my birth father still be alive? I had absolutely no clue as to who my birth parents were or where they were. Finding my birth family had always been a dream for me, and although I had friends who were encouraging me to hire a private detective, that didn't feel like the right way to go about it. I joined ALMA, an adoptee research group, and learned that an adoptee could get non-identifying information regarding his or her birth family. So, late in 1990, while on a business trip in Northern California, I visited the Bureau of Vital Statistics at 744 P Street in Sacramento. I entered the building and walked up to the counter. An older black man with a generous smile asked me how he could help. I told him of my request and he wrote down a note. "Wait here, I'll be right back." He disappeared behind a double door. I waited for a few minutes and he returned with an even wider smile. "Oh yes, there is definitely information back there in your file. All you need to do is sign some papers and we'll mail the information to you." I wanted to beg him to provide me with some detail, anything he could give me, or better yet, pull the damn file and let me see my original birth certificate. Please? No such luck. In a letter dated January 4th, 1991, I received my non-identifying information and read it over. Although the information was considered non-identifying, there were certain details that infuriated me. I called my friend Anne, who knew of my long struggle to find my birth family, and vented about my disappointment at the lack of any clue to their identity. Why was this so difficult? I could feel my anger rising. Her response to my despair was clear and profound. Sometimes it takes an external crisis to heal the internal one. She was right. Being adopted had been an internal crisis for me since third grade. Now, some 30 years later, that crisis was escalating. Anne was a marriage and family therapist by profession, but she was also my closest friend and neighbor. It was my good fortune to be in her realm, but she gently told me, "This is something much deeper than you and I will want to go. I want you to see a friend of mine, Dr. Carl Hammerschlag. Carl is a psychiatrist in private practice who has worked for years in mind, body, and spirit awareness and has spent time with Native Americans in the Southwest. You might want to read his book, The Dancing Healers, to get a sense of his work. I believe you will benefit from spending time with him. He will help you see in new ways." I called him immediately to set up an appointment and then went to the bookstore to buy his book. A few days later, I entered his office on Camelback Road, filled with beautiful Native American art and sculpture. A tall man with a calming voice, Dr. Hammerschlag welcomed me with a smile and sweet acknowledgement of Anne, our mutual friend. As our time together began, he lit a candle and told me we were entering a sacred space. He then placed dried sage in an abalone shell and lit it with a match. The sound of the sage crackling as it burned and the sweet, distinct smell captured my attention immediately. He waved an eagle feather, fanning the smoke, first toward me, then to him, and said, "This smoke will give color and meaning to our words." I told him that I had been adopted at birth through a private physician in California, and that I had recently traveled to the Bureau of Vital Statistics in Sacramento to sign papers to receive birth information in the mail. Then I began to tell him how angry I was when I read the non-identifying information I received. They were married. My father already had his Bachelor of Science degree in physical chemistry at the age of 20. He wrote that he was too busy getting an advanced degree and had neither the time nor the finances to keep me. My mother wrote that she wanted to be a mother and keep me, but she went along with her husband's wishes. Why would he do that to me? And why didn't she speak up? My anger was intense. I started crying so hard that seeing Dr. H was like looking through a rainy windshield with no wipers. I couldn't stop crying. He waited patiently for the tears to subside and gently asked the question, "Do you know about the rule of 25? "No." My sobbing was now muffled, but I couldn't stop shaking. I realized that this was the first time I had ever gotten physically upset and angry about being adopted. I had often felt betrayed and abandoned by my birth parents, but this was the first time my whole body shook with anger down to my soul. Dr. H continued to wait patiently as the tears continued to burst forth. Then, finally, quiet filled the room, and in a gentle voice, he brought me back to center. Once you are beyond the age of 25, you must forgive your parents. The way they felt at that moment of your birth may not have been the way they felt later on. More tears, more conversation. My first hour with Dr. Hammerschlag went by too quickly. At the end of the session, when it was time to extinguish the candle and go back out there in the world, he said a blessing for me. I felt better. Here was someone I could open up to without judgment, and here I could be the little girl crying, not the wife, mother, and professional businesswoman I had to be out there. On my way home, as I was driving west on Camelback Road, with the afternoon sun in my eyes and the tears still flowing, John Lennon's song, Imagine, came on the radio. I cried so hard I probably should have pulled over. I sang along. It was a defining moment in my life. This was the beginning of understanding who I was and why I was placed on this planet. My dear friend Anne had introduced me to a healer. As the therapy sessions with Dr. Hammerschlag progressed, I learned how to live in harmony by telling my story. He told me of the importance of having my head, my heart, and my lips in alignment. What I thought, what I felt, and what I said, all in balance. During the sessions, I cried a lot. It was time to let go of past hurts. The layers of sadness were slowly peeling away. He had a way of making words come alive through clear and profound images. In order to move forward, he said, there is the need to let go. Like the snake who sheds his skin. Near the end of each session, he would tell me a Native American story and give me a blessing to let me know that nobody makes it alone, and that we are all related. He also convinced me to have faith in the process of the work we are doing together and stressed the importance of being a participant in my own healing. He gave me a hug and told me that I was brave and strong. Your history is not your destiny. After several weekly sessions, Dr. Hammerschlag invited me to participate in a Native American-led sweat lodge ceremony. He and his Navajo friends had already prepared the lodge, digging a pit in the center, bending long wood branches and tying them to form a large dome over the pit, and finishing by laying large pieces of canvas over it all. As we all arrived on the property for the sweat, the Navajo leader was building the wood fire to heat the stones that would be carried into the sweat lodge. The sweat lodge ceremony included 4 rounds. It began after the heated stones were brought in and placed in the center pit. The participants were called to enter the lodge, one by one, to form a sacred circle around the center. For the first round of my first sweat lodge, I was about the 6th of 12 people to enter and be seated, so I was in the middle with people on both sides of me. We sat cross-legged on the ground in tight quarters in a circle surrounding the hot stones. When the canvas flap over the opening closed, it became dark inside and I started to panic. When the leader poured the water over the stones and began praying, it was hot, steamy, dark, and scary in there. Out of respect for the others in the sweat who are dealing with their own fears, anger, and sadness, you did not exit. What you experience in the lodge is like a microcosm of what you experience in life. In that first round, I wanted to jump ship and bail out of there. I held my head down and cried, the tears mixing with the sweat. I made it through the first round and we all came out of the lodge to cool off. For the subsequent rounds, I made sure I was either the first or the last person to enter the lodge, so I would be closest to the door. It was my life's philosophy being played out before me. Always be closest to the door. Always be ready to move on a moment's notice. Despite my fears, there were deeply healing moments, hearing songs like Amazing Grace and other spirituals sung in the language of the Navajo people. It was in the sweat lodge, a blending of cultures, that I began to realize what Dr. Hammerschlag taught me, Mitakwiyasan. We are all related. Over time, I did learn to forgive my birth parents, yet I still had no inkling as to who they were. I began to feel more at ease in telling my story, no longer ashamed that I had been given away at birth. I was proud to know, at the very least, that my birth parents were married and my birth father was some sort of brainiac, perhaps a professor at a university somewhere. I thought about my birth mother, and every time my birthday came around, I said a prayer, hoping she was okay. Over several months of therapy, I kept my friend Anne up to date on my progress with Dr. Hammerschlag. During one of our afternoon tea times, she revealed she had been diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and would be going through chemotherapy. I should have been comforting her, but she ended up comforting me. She had often spoke about finding her ancestral home. Not one to let my free airline miles expire, after Anne finished chemotherapy, I said, "Let's go," and we flew to England. We found the church and baptismal font in her great-grandparents' town of Bovie Tracy by visiting a local pub and merely mentioning her maiden name. At the church graveyard, we walked among the old headstones. Just as Anne was getting ready to take a picture, a dog lifted his leg and started to pee on a headstone. She snapped its picture and titled it, "Piss on Death." We walked down the street to have tea and scones and conversation at the old cottage tea shop in Bovie Tracy. My non-identifying information stated that I was of English descent, so, in a special way, I could share Anne's joy with the anticipation that someday I might find my ancestral home, too. In her Christmas letter that year, Anne wrote, "The English grow weary of the intensity of history. I, as an American, have missed the grounding that comes from standing in the place where my ancestors stood." That concludes today's broadcast. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona, and we've been reading Late for the Bus, an Adoption Story. I'm your volunteer reader, Lee Close. Thank you.